So my work is on the role of the internet for political social movements, particularly in Palestine, Lebanon, partly Jordan, but the Middle East in general since the last few months, which means that I'm a bit spoiled and always expect that there would be internet connection, but it's not really important. If it doesn't work, forget it. It's
no,
not
we're
really
getting connected.
Yeah? Okay. So before I start, I think about before I start to get into the whole topic of the role of the internet for the. Sorry, I'm a bit distracted. Anyway, I'll just continue. Yeah. Before I start about the role of the internet for social movements in the Middle East, a few critical remarks and maybe some provocative points of interest I'd like to address. I mean, first of all, of course, we have to admit and acknowledge that it's very clear that the revolutions that started in Tunisia and Egypt have renewed and polarized debate about the role of the internet, specifically the role of the internet for political change and spur of articles and debate and discussions. It almost became like if you would add the term Facebook or Twitter in your title for an article, it would be published in The Guardian or The Times. Or so, I mean, so there's a whole, there's a enormous dynamic debate, and sometimes it's a bit difficult to sort of take a step back and try to realize what really the impact of social and or new media is. It's also problematic because the debates are very topical. And there's this, as I said, this race for sort of academic or journalistic niche that everybody wants to get, so the debates are usually reduced to very polemical claims, which are either very dystopian or very utopian. One of the commentators I thought made a very relevant critique was Mejias, who argued that this whole Facebook and Twitter hype performs two grand functions. First of all, it depoliticizes conflict. That's very important because, I mean, these are very political, complex conflicts, and, you know, giving it a Facebook or Twitter framework depoliticizes that incredibly. But the second point also of critique was that it whitewashes corporate capitalism, because we start to talk about Facebook and Twitter as if they're, you know, comrades in the struggle and there for change. But of course, these are at the same time multi-million or billion companies. They don't even know how to value them. That is the extent of the sort of insanity of these companies. And I think that the critique of whitewashing corporate capitalism was very painfully accurate during the Egyptian revolution, when Vodafone and France Telecom, who provide most of the mobile telecom connections in Egypt, basically just obliged to the regime's request to cut the lines. And they did that because they were threatened by, you know, the fact that I would jeopardize potential business deals. So this whole idea of, you know, media and freedom and political change is embedded in these sort of hardcore political economic realities. So that needs to be stated. On the other hand, assertions that the internet or social media have no effect on the dynamic of revolution, and that then being counterposed by assertions that these technologies had a major determining effect on the revolutions, are basically unsatisfactory. They are very well placed in, I think, hyped newspaper debates, but they're very unsatisfactory for, I think, an academic debate or discussion. Because, first of all, such perspectives, I think they isolate the internet also from other media, and they isolate the internet, of course, from society. The internet being part of society, people use them on their own terms, in their own ways, etc. So without the society, without the cultural shaping of the technology, The technology wouldn't exist, but without the technology itself, of course, people wouldn't have something to shape or to mold into their own interest. So that is a sort of a general important critique to make. It sounds so self-evident, but we've come to the point that we really need to sort of repeat these very simple, basic understandings. And I think that a much more comprehensive outline, which I also employ in my work in Palestine and Lebanon, is to understand the internet as having basically a dialectical impact, of the internet being a blessing and a curse at the same time. So interestingly, some of the essentializing projections about technology that we've seen, whether dystopian or utopian, have also occurred about the Arabs themselves in the last few months. I mean, I remember front page of The Economist talking about the Arab awakening. I mean, it's very old-fashioned Orientalist style representation of a people. But of course, the matter of fact is that the region, if we want to talk about the region as a whole, was in turmoil for over a decade, extreme turmoil. I mean, this started with social and political protests. First of all, the outbreak of the Second Intifada in 2000, mass mobilization against the war in Iraq, and huge protests in several countries, particularly in Egypt, very interesting explosion of demonstrations calling for constitutional reform in 2004-2005, which is also taken up by judges. We've seen that in Pakistan, but also in Egypt. Judges marching in the streets, like kind of a segment of society that no one would associate with activism, which only says how deep the anger and the divisions were in society. The last straw, probably in Egypt, was the election in October, which by some miracle, Mubarak again won by 99.9% or something like that. And in the same period also, large strikes, enormous strikes in textile sector and other working class cities. This was all on the background of what was referred to in the last few months as the internet revolution, the internet-enabled revolution. And I think that if we want to see similarities between Tunis, Egypt, Algeria, then we can say that it's actually the economic impact, the impact of sort of the neoliberal privatization demanded by IMF and World Bank, in combination with increasing prices due to the financial global crisis, which really meant literally that, you know, something that cost £1 2 years ago would be £10 today. These crises have set in motion the political struggles and mobilized and politicized millions of people long before this whole Facebook debate started. This also makes me come to the point that the protests were anything but spontaneous, and I think that's another myth we need to take into consideration, because it seemed like if you would hear the discourses, the debates, as if there was nothing, people were sleeping, and then, oh, there was social networking, Web 2, and then they woke up, and there was a spontaneous outburst of anger. On that, for instance, on 25th of January in Egypt, the 25th of January revolution. Of course, it was anything but spontaneous, and it required weeks and months of preparation and build up. And for Egypt, clearly Tunisia was the tipping point. The fact that Tunisia showed you can actually topple a dictator who, you know, who has a monopoly over violence and has subjugated its people for 3 decades. That was a tipping point, not the Facebook mobilizations. The Facebook mobilization stepped into that tipping point. That is a very important note to be made. It's even more complex, actually, because those, if you I'm a political anthropologist, so I've been most of my methodology is doing interviews with the very activists on the ground. And if you just scratch the surface a little bit, you would find that a lot of those people behind the Facebook groups that were presented as being, you know, new, apolitical in a way, new politics versus the old politics, traditional politics, were themselves partly these Facebook groups were partly inhabited by activists who were part of the mainstream political groups. So I mean, some of the activists, a lot of them were, of course, obviously anonymous. You had to operate in an anonymous fashion under dictatorial regimes. But I mean, if you scratch the surface a bit and you know the milieus, you find that these are also people who are active in. Some of them were active in the Muslim Brotherhood, some in Marxist groups, some in new, you know, student groups that have no political, ideological affiliation. But nevertheless, they were offline political groups, which also were represented in these big Facebook groups. So that is a very interesting, I think, discovery that rather than the idea that new media, and I think this can speak to all the people who are doing research about new media, rather than the idea that new media also assumes new politics, a completely new style, you could say non-ideological. I think that's almost the wishful thinking of a lot of writing, that it's non-ideological. It partly is that, but it certainly is also anything but that in many cases. Another fine example that I thought was also stories about, I mean, I don't know if you've seen pictures, but there were a couple of fascinating pictures from Egypt where you could see lines and lines of police and riot police being confronted with ordinary people, but faced by non-armed civilians who would basically jump into the crowd of police and take big risks, and people were making jokes about them. Who are these giants? Who are these? Where did they come from? And well, those were actually people from what they call football hooligans. Those were people from very well-known football fan clubs in Egypt. And it occurs that without their expertise in dealing with riot police, which football hooligans usually have, the protest wouldn't have survived, you know? Like, it was really their bringing in their expertise on how to deal with the riot police, how to avoid rubber bullets, how to stop their jeeps, etc. So those are kind of offline, completely unrelated to Web2 elements that made this revolution survive. So let's juxtapose this with that popular representation in mainstream media. And I'm sorry to be so critical and maybe ruin some of the beautiful narratives about the fantastic stories of Facebook, but I just want to stay true also to my work. I think also if we want to have a more critical sort of conceptual analysis of why this big juxtaposition and paradox actually of what was represented in mainstream media, particularly I think in Western mainstream media, because this whole thing about Facebook, and it was really, if you look at the different newspapers in different regions, it was very much a European, North American discourse. It was much little present in the Arab press, for instance. But for me, it seemed almost as if by repeatedly putting these sort of internet corporations like Facebook and Twitter at the center, literally, I mean, putting that in the center of your title of a piece is almost putting it in the center of what happened. It's almost like as if there were particular Western characteristics artificially being inserted in Arab revolutions, which were anything but Western. And it was almost like a very good example, I think, is Jonathan Friedman's piece about the role of Google in awakening the Arab mind. It was almost as if it's this frustration of there's something going on there against all odds. We all thought that they were sort of passive, sleeping, they don't do anything, they're just being oppressed. And then suddenly they actually more brave and more democratic than we wish we could be here? And then how do you insert something like some kind of relevant Western interpretation? And that was by making it into a Facebook and Twitter revolution. And I think that that is the reason why a lot of the people, me and a colleague, interviewed in Egypt and Tunisia about the revolutions were frustrated. They were not so much angry about the fact that it was mentioned that they used Facebook or Twitter, but I think a lot of the people we interviewed and activists on the ground were more angry by the fact that they were not being put in the center of the political radical changes that happened, but a technology. So that is, I mean, that is, I think, an important critical a commentary to make about this a whole debate, which of course in the last minute of my talk, which doesn't represent how I think about it, but in the last minute I would like to state that it doesn't mean at all that the internet didn't play a role. On the contrary, let's take for example Egypt, or let's take the region. It has the highest growth rate of internet penetration in the world. I mean, this is astonishing. It had over the last 8-9 years almost 2,000% growth rate. This is amazing. And then combine that with the fact that the region has among the youngest population, which means that there's a generation growing up which are going to be internet domesticated. They're just going to know by default how to open a Facebook account and read emails. So, I mean, the potentialities are enormous. And Egypt, being a country of 80 million, 82 million, has about 23 million broadband internet users, of which 9 million, by the way, mobile phone internet users, which is quite impressive. And also, after Facebook opened its Arabic version in 2009, the numbers tripled, or more than tripled, of Facebook users in Egypt. And there are more of these data, which shows actually when it comes to internet usage and internet penetration, it is incredible. If you compare the socioeconomic situation with across the globe, you would almost say it's over average. It's more if you compare like what people can afford. I'm sure that I've seen figures of southern sub-Saharan Africa where there are relative comparisons when you take into consideration also the level of poverty, the level of education, etc. So absolutely crucial element, the internet, in terms of the domestication, the average everyday life patterns of usage. But in terms of how to put internet with regards to other forms of media, even for me as an internet researcher, I would have to say that, of course, in terms of shaping public opinion, which is one of the most, I think, important impacts of internet media, it's about organizing the activism, but also shaping opinion. In terms of shaping public opinion, it's not as close as Al Jazeera or other satellite TV media. So in terms of comparing it with other forms of ICT mediums, I would say Al Jazeera in the revolutions of the last few months played a revolutionary role compared to the media. And I think that I'll end up with a quote from Hillary Clinton, who basically said herself, Al Jazeera has been the leader in changing people's minds and attitudes, and like it or hate it, it is really effective. And I think that is also part of the reason why perhaps Al Jazeera is now in negotiations in the States, in America, to actually allow it to air on American satellite, because the American administration, I think the Europeans as well, are understanding if you want to win the war over, you know, the war of the public opinion, you need to do that through their channels of policy, of sort of public opinion making. And I think Jazeera is going to become one of those mainstream million reaching audience satellite channels that will do that. And that, in comparison with the internet, we have to admit, is superior. So I'd like to leave it at that. I had an example that I wanted to show for a minute, but I think, I don't know, I think I talked more than I should, so I don't think I should. Should I show something about...
It's very short, isn't it?
Well, it is a video. It's a YouTube video. I know, I mean, of course, when we talk about shaping public opinion, one of the most important things is to understand that in countries where you have a high level of censorship... Oh. Desko. See, this is what I mean by corporate. I'm just pressing a T. when it comes to public opinion, critique to the regimes and leaderships are, of course, totally absent in mainstream media. So in that sense, YouTube played an enormous role. And this is an example from Tunisia. This is a kid called El General. He's a Tunisian rapper who basically, they say that this was the call to revolution. And I just want to show a few seconds to show the effect of the media, the new media, internet media, the effect it has on attaching to different sensors of the audience. There's one thing to read stuff. There's something else to hear the audio and the visual sensors of that YouTube, for instance, generated. This was a track that came out during the protests called "Tunis Bladna," that means Tunis is our country, before it was taken down. Of course, it was taken down within a day or something. But before it was taken down, it was already downloaded thousands and thousands of times throughout the whole region. Everybody understood it, whether you were Moroccan, Tunisian, Egyptian, etc. And they call it the call to revolution. And why I want to show it is because it shows how it integrates a political message and just basic popular culture. So a collage of very critical images against Ben Ali, and how that speaks to the audience. But this internet connection is not lending itself to this, because I see that it needs to be. I think you need to buffer it, right? So maybe we'll just leave it, because this, I think the connection is a bit weak, so it needs to buffer. So maybe I'll, what do you think? Just write it down if you're interested in this, El General. And there's more clips on the internet. Yeah, but that's only the first few seconds, and then it will continue buffering, I think. Well, if you want to see a bit. So the sweet thing is, now we have the image, but you don't have the sound. So I suggest we just leave it. Yeah? All right. I'll leave it here. You can always email me, or I'll send you nice video clips. So.
Thank you very much.